Okay. Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for March 31st. It's awfully noisy back there. Thank you. We're going to get started with Senate Bill 805. We had a hearing last Tuesday and we had carried over some of the testimony. So we're going to reopen that public hearing and take the testimony that was left over. So we're going to be doing that first, just so you know. And then next, actually, because we have our Attorney General here for Senate Bill 941, so we will do that second. Then we will go on with Senate Bill 695, work session. Then we'll have the public hearing on 945, and we'll do Senate Bill 600 last. So sorry about the jumping around. Senator Johnson, we're going to do Senate Bill 600 last, unless that's a problem for you.
Fine, Madam Chair. I was just going to leave where I am with the staff.
Great. I heard we're going to call you. Is that correct? Okay. Great. Okay. So with that, we're going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 805. And we have four people signed up that unfortunately ran out of time. So I'd like to make sure and call them up so we can hear their testimony. Ted Paul and Margaret Stevens. Is Ted here? Okay. Margaret Stevens. They didn't come back. Okay. I have Katie Fast and Jim Welsh. You bringing us some eggs?
All right.
I'm not going to throw them at you, though.
I was going to say. I hope he can ask you the which came first, the chicken
right.
or the egg question.
Or the carton.
And Jim Welsh. Jim's not here. Okay.
Good afternoon, Katie. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. In the committee hearing on Tuesday, there was a lot of testimony, I think, around the price of eggs. And so today I thought I'd run down to Ross IGA here in Salem and just check prices. And what I saw was conventional Oregon eggs priced $2.19. That would be banned under 805. Cage-free eggs varied anywhere from $3.69 to $5. This version was $4.29. And 95% of Oregon consumers go with this version that costs around $2, $2.19. And that's a choice that they're making at the grocery store in terms of the animal care standards that those eggs are produced under, along with the price and what that means to their pocketbook. Under 805, there's a choice that's going to be taken away from consumers to purchase not eggs raised in this fashion, but Oregon eggs raised in this fashion. There will still be a demand to pay around a little over $2 for eggs. But those are going to be imported in from other states that don't meet the Oregon criteria. And that's why Oregon Farm Bureau cannot support Senate Bill 805. It'll force Oregon farmers that are currently producing eggs out of the state or out of business. However, Farm Bureau hopes that we can find an alternative bill to be brought forward, and we are appreciative of the work of Senator Courtney to find that Oregon solution that takes the politics out of the issue and finds animal care standards that are economically feasible for both the farm community and the consumer. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Katie. Any questions? This is like... I'm losing members left and right here.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Or not unless Senator Thompson would like has one. Thank you, Ms. Fast, for coming in. If we were to go to the new cages, how much of an impact on the buildings themselves? How much bigger would the buildings have to be to contain these new cages for the quantity of chickens that are in each building today?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, you know, I have to admit, I don't know if I have the exact answer for that. I think it's around maybe not bigger buildings, but more buildings, and I believe it's a building and a half compared to what would be housed under a current system, and those numbers, I have to admit, might not be accurate.
Okay. Follow up. How many people, maybe you can answer this one, I don't know if you know this number, how many people are employed in the egg business in Oregon?
It is somewhere between 250 to 300 employees.
Okay, one follow-up. How many eggs does Oregon produce as compared to the overall eggs that Oregon uses in a day?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, we Oregonians consume, Oregon producers, I think, produce about one-third of the eggs that Oregonians consume. And that would be in multiple fashions, in a liquid and a shelled form.
One more, if you don't mind.
Follow up,
thank you. It was said in testimony last week that it would be anywhere from $35 million to $100 million to make this transition over to these new cages. Do you not think that at that price it would put our egg producers at an economic disadvantage to those people that import into our state that don't have the same regulations and rules?
So, Senator Dingfelder and Senator Olson, not only do I think that if Senate Bill 805 would move forward that our producers would be at an economic disadvantage, I don't think they would be able to meet the standards and be able to have a market for their eggs, and they would not even be able to stay in business in this state because of the cost to their production would be increased in such a dramatic rate, and there would not be the market to move those eggs into.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Katie. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill before we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 805? Yes? Hi, sorry. We're
Chair.
Trying to, there's a lot of noise coming out that way, and it's very hard for us to hear people, the witnesses, so we're trying to get it quieted down.
Would you like me to proceed?
Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. I want to make two very brief points, and then I'll be done. First, the producers that are coming to you here in the Oregon legislature to advocate for a implementation date of 2025 have agreed to an implementation date of 2019 in Washington. So the same producers are asking for a much longer period of time in Oregon than they are in Washington. Why? We don't know, but we believe that if they can do it in Washington, certainly they can do it here in Oregon. The second is the United Egg Producers commissioned their own independent study on the cost of implementing a cage-free system for eggs, and the United Egg Producers' own study concludes that it costs less than 1 cent per egg to implement these changes. With that, I'm open to any questions.
And is this your testimony, written testimony?
Yes, and just for purposes of clarification, the handout that I've provided gives our arguments against the Dash 6 amendments, and also provides you with a chart that compares the original version of Senate Bill 805 with the Dash 6 amendments.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. Thank questions? You. Senator Thompson?
Thank you, sir. Chairman Dingfelder, you said a penny for the penny per egg. Can you
yes.
give me the total cost instead of a...
I don't know the total cost. I just know that the study that was commissioned by the United Egg Producers reached that conclusion.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yes, I have a question. Do you mind?
Yep. Go ahead.
Why do you exempt scrambled eggs, liquid eggs?
We exempt liquid eggs because the enforcement would be so incredibly difficult and expensive to enforce. I also want to clarify that contrary to the testimony that was delivered before me today, the sale of shelled eggs, so whole intact eggs, will be banned, so that all shelled eggs sold in Oregon after the implementation date would have to come from cage-free systems.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
I have a feeling this isn't the last we'll hear about chickens. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing. Make sure I've got the right bill number on 805. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 941. Beth, if you can provide an overview, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 941 would modify provisions related to civil penalties issued by a number of different agencies, all natural resource agencies. It would direct penalty monies into the Department of Justice Protection and Education Revolving Account and require that fines imposed in certain cases, criminal cases, be in the form of compensatory fines. There is a Dash 1 amendment that you should have in your packet. We don't have a revenue or fiscal impact statement on the amendment yet, and there is no subsequent referral.
Okay, great. And we have our Attorney General, John Kroger, and Paul, do you want to come up with him? Would like to testify. Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thanks for having me. Over the last 2 years, we've attempted to build...
John, I need you to say your name for the record, please.
It's been a long day. Madam Chair, I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. I'm joined by Paul Garahan, who's special counsel at the Oregon Department of Justice. Over the last couple of years, we've attempted to build a more professional environmental enforcement program for the state of Oregon. And the basic principles that have governed that effort are first, to make sure that cases are treated the same regardless of where they occur in the state, so that an individual or a company isn't treated to a higher standard simply because they happen to be in one county versus another. And second, we've tried to make sure that cases are treated appropriately. We have three different enforcement types of cases: administrative cases, civil cases, and criminal cases. And we meet regularly with all of the natural resources agencies to discuss various cases and make sure that the most serious cases are handled criminally. Those cases that require an injunction are handled in civil court, and then the overwhelming majority of cases, more routine cases, are handled administratively. As a byproduct of ongoing discussions with all the agencies and our various enforcement actions over the last 2 years, we've identified a number of what we view as relatively technical fixes to Oregon statutes to allow us to do our jobs better. And that is the goal of this bill, which we would urge the committee to consider and pass. There are basically five main things that this bill does. First, we've discovered that there are a number of natural resource agencies that do not have explicit statutory authority to go to court to get an injunction to enjoin ongoing activities. Oregon goes to court to get injunctions in environmental cases very, very rarely. We use it typically to stop an ongoing environmental hazard or to prevent an imminent environmental hazard from occurring. ODFW, the Department of Forestry and the Water Resources Department currently don't have explicit authority to get an injunction, and so this bill would give them that authority. Second, we discovered that the different agencies don't have uniform authority as to how they can get an injunction and the rules that apply when they go to get an injunction. And that leaves the state with some liability for its actions in getting an injunction because the proper protections are not in place. So this would make all of the injunction authority of the various state agencies uniform. The injunction authority would be patterned on what we believe is the best injunction statute currently, which is that in the Department of State lands. And so there would be, particularly in all of the relevant state departments, if they went to seek an injunction, there would be an explicit provision that would hold the state free from liability for any outcome of the injunction. It would provide for uniform jurisdiction, either in Marion County or where the violation occurred. It would state that the state government agency would not have to get a bond, which is the current standard in DSL. So it would try to make those the injunction authority uniform and apply to all the natural resource agencies. Third, right now, if we seek an injunction in court in a case where penalties are also appropriate, we have to have two different actions. We have to have a civil action to go get the injunction in circuit court and an administrative case to go get the fine or the penalty. And as a result, this doubles the expense, both for the state government, which has to file two actions, but also for the alleged polluter who has to defend separate legal actions, one the administrative action from the agency and a separate one to defend the state attempt to get an injunction. And so this would allow explicitly the state in a case where it is seeking injunction to also seek penalties in that civil proceeding rather than having to have bifurcated proceedings which double the expense for both the state and the parties. Fourth, there's a mechanism to improve the funding of cases where we go to get an injunction. And the simple thing I would tell you is in the last 2 years, we've only gone to get one injunction in an environmental case. It was a case where there was an imminent environmental hazard that could occur, and we got a court order to prevent the hazard. We're talking about an extraordinarily small number of cases. I would imagine at most we'd be seeking 1 to 3 injunctions per biennium because these cases where an injunction is appropriate are relatively rare. The problem is getting an injunction is relatively expensive in court, and most of the agencies do not have these cases are so rare, their legal budgets are not set up to fund an injunction. And so in some cases, they really have to come to us, and we have to sort of figure out how we're going to pay for a case that they really have no provision to pay for. So the bill does two things. First, it allows us to use the P&E account, which is the basic criminal enforcement, environmental enforcement, and consumer protection revolving fund, and to draw funds on that account if a state agency wishes to seek an injunction. And second, any fines or penalties that were gathered in that case in the civil proceeding would go back into the P&E account to offset the cost of bringing that litigation. And then finally, there's a fifth provision in the bill, and I'm actually a little embarrassed to tell you it's to repair something that we brought to you last time, and as Senator Olson and I were discussing earlier, we brought a piece of legislation which didn't accomplish what we hoped to accomplish. In the 2009 session, when the legislature created our environmental crimes unit, there was language in the bill that was designed to allow the Department of Justice to recover the fines in its criminal environmental cases and to have those fines go back to the protection and enforcement account to help offset the cost of bringing those prosecutions. And the language of the bill did not accomplish what we hoped to do. What it said is that any fines that come to the Department of Justice in these cases will go to that account, but it didn't actually divert those fines from the criminal fines and assessment account. And so this language in this bill would accomplish what we believe was the intention of the legislature in 2009, which is allow fines and penalties in environmental crimes cases to go back into the consumer protection account. Again, this is a relatively small amount of funding that is at stake. We currently have we've indicted 7 environmental crimes cases in the last 2 years, and the amount of fines and penalties in those cases was approximately $10,000 to $12,000. So that is the amount of money, had this provision been in place, that would have gone to the protection and education account rather than in the criminal fines and assessment account. So those are the 5 major provisions of the bill. I'm sorry they're a little technical, but that's what the bill accomplishes, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Paul, did you want to add anything, or are you here to answer questions?
Chair Dingfelder, I'm here to help answer questions.
Okay, great. Any questions? I know we heard a similar bill in our Judiciary Committee, so we had a discussion there, but any questions for the Attorney General?
I just have one.
Sure.
Chair Dingfelder. I'm real comfortable, and I think I actually understood most of what you told me. It's not easy being us sometimes, especially when you're new at this. The only kind of question I have is, and I understand the fine money going back into that fund. The kind of argument I hear here is we have to be real careful with because the legislature controls the purse strings in this building, and the arguments are to keep as much of the fine money going into general fund so it doesn't look to the public like if there'll be more fines because it goes right back into your department. And I, can you talk to that just a second, or?
Absolutely, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, that's a legitimate concern. The model here is really the same model we use in our consumer protection cases. All of the department's consumer protection operations are effectively self-funded. We receive no general funds from the legislature. We use volunteers to man the hotlines, and then we fund investigations and lawsuits by the fines and penalties we recover from settlements and from people who are judged to have broken the law. And that's the same model that we're using in this small range of civil and criminal environmental cases under this bill. I can tell you, one might have a sort of concern that then lawyers would sort of be bounty hunters, right? And they're trying to make sure their budgets are adequate, and so they're bringing cases that are motivated by that rather than the public interest. I can tell you we're highly conscious of that concern. In the criminal cases, we have a clear ethical prohibition. A lawyer would be disbarred for bringing a criminal case for that reason. And on the civil environmental cases, we're really talking about an extraordinarily small number. I mean, we've done one of these in the past 2 years, and they're really motivated. In that case, we had an outdoor lagoon that was holding approximately 2 million gallons of sewage that was leaking and might break, and we got an injunction ordering them to pump down the waste and dispose of it before the dam broke and the sewage was discharged into a river. So this will affect a very small number of cases, and I guess the other thing I would say is the CP&E account is regularly reviewed by our Ways and Means Subcommittee, and how much money is in the account and where it came from is something that we review. We actually last year had an additional surplus. We had funds from our consumer protection effort beyond what we needed to fund our existing cases, and we returned that money to the general fund. So there is very much oversight about where the money is coming from and where it goes in that account. Thanks.
Okay. Senator Przanski, sorry, we're having, it's very hard to hear because there's a lot of noise out there, so I'm trying to keep the door closed.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, if I could, I just want to follow up with the question that Senator Thompson put out. And John, I guess just to make certain we're all on the same page, I understand the cost that you go through and what the, let's say, reimbursement is under the, or back into the Justice Protection Education Revolving Account.
Thank you, Rachel.
Would there be any reason, because this coming up in other bills and stuff, to have, if for some reason the amount of your services was less than what the civil penalties and fines were, instead of reimbursed into that amount, but any excess to go back or into the general fund? I'm wondering, I would expect that's not going to happen just because of the amount of hours that you put in the billable rate for that time. But if for some reason there was a significant penalty that was assessed by the court, I'm wondering if that might be some way to alleviate some of the concerns I've heard in now two committees.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Przanski, we effectively do that now.
Okay.
So that in the I'm doing this off the top of my head, but last in front of the last legislative session, we had a sufficient number amount of money built up in the protection and education account that we worked with the subcommittee of Ways and Means, and they swept back, I believe, about $3 million out of that fund, which was beyond what we needed. So if there's ever a case where we get a giant windfall in an environmental case, and I expect that the odds of that are very small, but it could happen, that the mechanism is already in place, and that's a somewhat standard procedure for the subcommittee to review what's in the P&E account and sweep back additional funding beyond what we need. Just by, I can tell you the cost of getting an injunction if it's defended aggressively by the party on the other side is well in excess of the kinds of fines and penalties we would get in an environmental case. I mean, the fact that in our cases where we've gotten criminal convictions and environmental crimes cases to date, we've only been able to recover $10,000 or $12,000 which is much less than the cost of those prosecutions and investigations, indicates to me we're unlikely to have that scenario. But if we did, the mechanism's in place to deal with it.
Great. I just want to put that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the Attorney General or his staff? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We have one more person that would like to testify on this bill, Rich Angstrom. And anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 941? Okay, Rich.
Good afternoon. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association, known as OCAPA. I represent all the construction materials companies in the state of Oregon. I have not seen the amendments yet, so I am going to speak to the bill. So some of the comments that I might make, my opinion might change, once I've seen the amendments. And I do want to look at those, and I have talked to John today and want to be engaged in this particular discussion. Not all of my views, as I've said in the other committee, Senate Bill 42, are views of OCAPA. Some of them are just general business views. Some of them are from my own experience as a prosecutor for the state in the past. I do want to say that I don't speak for ODAA. I did get a phone call after the last one, and I want to assure the guys, because I know they're listening, I do not speak for them. But I offer that as an experience to the committee. In prosecuting environmental crimes, that was one of the things I did for several counties. I kept it all the way up, all of them went all the way up as I advanced in the district attorney's office. As many of you know, my background is in fish and wildlife and forestry, and I spent most of my life in the natural resources area and was a very aggressive prosecutor when it came to environmental crimes and was one of the highlights of my career, and really that's the one part of being a DA I enjoyed. I did not enjoy doing sex abuse cases, for the record.
That's our other committee. So.
Yeah.
Rich, a question I have for you, because the dash ones are quite a bit different. Do you want to take a look at the dash ones and get your comments to us? Because I think that might be helpful, given that it's quite a bit different from the original version.
Madam Chair, if I can make some general points on the philosophy instead of just walking through the bill, which I did want to do, I think that would be good. And then if this does come up for a work session and you would allow me to come before the committee just to clarify some points.
Absolutely. Yep.
And if I have any questions,
you'll talk to the Attorney General.
He and I can visit. I just want to say this. As the general philosophy of where we're headed with our AG's office, and this didn't just start with John. This is a process that's been going on, I think, maybe even starting with Frohmeyer and Hardy Myers and others. And that is is the move away from general fund funding our AG's office and to allowing them to act more in a kind of a private, just not truly sense, but as a analogy here, as a private entity, billing hours and collecting resources to run their program based on fines and the charges that they have, the time they spent with the different agencies. And as a general philosophy, I think we're headed down a path that we should be very concerned with. We should stop, set back, look at that very carefully, and say, do we want our prosecutors, our head prosecutor in the state of Oregon, to be self-funding that program? And I think even with all of the very tightly put together box that you could build around that, protecting both defendants and victims and others in the process, there's a huge appearance that's not appropriate conduct. Let me just give you just an analogy. We do not allow the state police to fund themselves through the number of tickets that they issue. And our prosecutor should not be allowed to do the same. It's the exact same philosophy. I think that state police officers go out and they pull over people because they did something wrong. But we should not make their wages and their programs dependent on that. Same with prosecution. The greatest power of, I think, almost any elected official is that prosecutorial discretion, and it absolutely has to be free and clear of all monetary interest in the outcome of a case. And I just, as a very broad perspective, think that we need to back up, think about this, look at how we're doing our budgets for this particular agency, and get them funded so they can do the work, so they can go after criminals, they can go after folks that are polluting our environment, but not in this way. So with that, I have a lot of specific comments on the bill, but I'm going to hold those, and I want to be just very consistent on that particular message, and hopefully engage not only many of you but the AG during the interim on this particular point. There's many of us that are concerned about it. Okay. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Engstrom? Thank you. And we will look forward to hearing your comments on the dash once. Okay. Anybody else would like to testify on Senate Bill 941? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 941. Okay, so we're sort of out of order in our agenda, but next we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 695. Beth, we have the, which dash are we on? The dash 8s, correct?
On the dash 8s, that's okay. Correct.
Do you want to talk about the dash 8s, and then I think we have, or Senator Boklis is going to talk about that?
I can.
Why don't you go ahead and do the intro, and then we'll have Senator Boklis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 8s make a number of changes to the bill. It is a gut and stuff amendment, so the entire bill is contained in the Dash 8. The amendments delete the infant formula container prohibition. They direct the Oregon Health Authority to approve and obtain for the WIC program only infant formula in containers that do not leach BPA into the formula of a certain 0.1 parts per billion or lined with certain materials effective January 1st, 2013. This does not apply to medically indicated formula. It requires the authority to report to an appropriate legislative committee by January 15th of 2012, removes provisions relating to metal cans, and creates the Oregon BPA-free advisory group, which is to report to the 67th Legislative Assembly on or before February 1st, 2012. It also lists the issues on which the group may provide advice and make recommendations to the Assembly.
Okay. Senator Boklis, thank you for being here. And if you can, just state your name for the record. And I know that we have some folks that can talk about the amendment as well. Renee is with you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Senator Brian Boquist, former member of the committee sitting in front of me, who has got at least three folders on this, at least 3 inches thick. So I think, Madam Chairman, I'm ahead of your vice chair, who's got two folders and catching quickly on me. If you'll indulge us, Madam Chair, I think what we'll do is going to ask Renee to kind of walk through the amendments, and then from there I'll address a couple issues that aren't in the bill and why they aren't there and why we have a Dash 8 version. And then from there, I'll be delighted, Madam Chair, to take questions from your left.
All right. Thank you. Renee.
All right. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis, and I'm the Environmental Health Program Director at Oregon Environmental Council. And I'm just going to walk through the amendments and the sections very quickly. I also have them written out, too, if you, I can hand to you also. So Section 1 provides definitions for bisphenol A, children's beverage containers, food, and reusable bottles. Section 2 bans the willful, knowing manufacture, distribution, and sale of bisphenol A containing children's beverage containers, and as defined in Section 1, that would be baby bottles and sippy cups, and also bans the willful, knowing manufacture, distribution, and sale of reusable bottles defined as 64 ounces or less. Section 2 also states that replacement chemicals for bisphenol A cannot be known carcinogens or reproductive toxicants as defined by the EPA. Section 3 requires that baby bottle, sippy cup, and reusable bottle manufacturers notify retailers 90 days prior to the effective date that the BPA ban will be implemented. Section 4 makes baby bottle, sippy cup, and reusable bottle manufacturers responsible for the cost of any associated recall after the effective date. Section 5 directs the Oregon Health Authority through the Women, Infants, and Children's WIC program to only approve infant formula for the WIC program having no more than 0.1 parts per billion, or PPB, detectable bisphenol A in the formula contained within those cans. It exempts special medically necessary WIC formula products from this provision. Section 6 establishes a bisphenol A-free advisory group to convene by the interim chair of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, Madam Chair, to make recommendations on a voluntary BPA-free label standard for Oregon. This group will report back to the legislature by February 1, 2012. Section 7 states that the baby bottle, sippy cup, and reusable bottle ban is enforced under the Unfair Trade Practices Law, ORS 646.608. Section 8 directs WIC to report on the availability of infant formula meeting the standard on or before January 15, 2012, 1 year prior to the effective date of January 1, 2013 for the infant formula standard. Section 9, manufacturers, retailers, and distributors are subject to Sections 2 and 4 of the Act starting on January 1, 2012. Section 10, the baby bottle, sippy cup, and recall provisions take effect on January 1, 2012. Section 11, the WIC baby formula, infant formula provision takes effect on January 1, 2013. And Section 12, the bill takes effect upon passage.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any questions for either of these witnesses?
Madam Chair, may I make a couple of comments?
Would you like to make a couple more comments?
Yeah, I would, Madam Chair. I want to point out what's not in the bill.
Okay.
What we would have liked to have in the bill and what's not. First thing, what's not in the bill or associated with the bill is a fiscal, because this is a pretty lean time. There is quite an impact this has positive in the market, and when this bill gets to the floor, I'm going to address that in considerable amount of detail of the market advantages, the job creation, the job preservation that this bill actually brings forth. The second thing that's not in here is it really doesn't have the labeling standard that we wanted, and let me explain that very briefly. I spent an inordinate amount of time talking to Oregon producers. Let me make that statement again. I spent an inordinate time talking to Oregon producers. I'm considered to be, a right-wing constitutionalist or a nationalist, but in this particular case, I was most interested in what Oregon businesses had to say, how we create Oregon jobs, what our Oregon companies do, and quite specifically, several in my district, what are they doing and how will this help them? And so in listening to them, they wanted a third-party, non-governmental standard so that they could certify their products through that entity. This is nothing new. We've done it before to help businesses. It's a great concept. We pretty much had an agreement on a standard. And when I say agreement, as you all know, there are many organizations that say we're opposed to this, we're opposed to that. But if you do pass it, you know, here's our suggestion. Unfortunately, when we came up with that standard, which is pretty industrially recognized, can be measured by the FDA, can be measured by virtually all nine major manufacturers that are 90% of the market, it had a fiscal. So we didn't get there. So I'm assuming I'm going to get tagged one more time by the interim committee chair to participate in another work group so that we can actually go back to something that really does exist and move forward with this over the next biennium or interim session in identifying what that standard is in a cool and collective means involving industry across the board. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be delighted to take any questions from your left.
Thank you, Senator Boquist, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank you for the inordinate amount of time that you spent on this, and you were reading the Chair's mind about thinking about who might be willing to sit on this advisory committee. And I certainly do appreciate the amount of time that you took on this component. And that you were on this committee last time, and I would like to comment that there was a minority report last time, and it looks very familiar, this bill, to the minority report from last time.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I issued that notice, too.
Yeah. So with that, happy to take any questions from my colleagues. Senator Olson, do you have a question?
I do have a question. Okay. To start with, do we have a typo in our report? Because it says the 67th Legislative Assembly.
Yes,
I think it could be. I think we'd have to go backwards.
I think it's, yes.
I whisper to the committee chair.
I will say in my committee staff's defense that she's nearly perfect.
Madam Chair, I'd be delighted to answer that question. Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Dingell, Senator Olson, if you expect to last long, don't ding your administrator.
Right. Yeah. Yes, the most important person in your life next to your wife is your husband, is your committee administrator.
You're more important.
Yes, maybe more so, because your wife calls it down.
Okay. I'm glad my husband
That's
hopefully
why
is
I only whispered it. You'll learn. You will learn.
A lesson well learned. Another lesson well learned. Thank you, Senator Boquist, for my two folders of study on this issue. I do have a couple questions for you, since you obviously have flipped from your last stance on this issue. You gave me some information here that says, reductions are probably prudent, even though knowledge about BPA is still incomplete and probably will be for decades to come. Since our information on BPA is so incomplete, since so many entities have not totally banned it, why is it necessary that Oregon be a leader in this effort?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'll give you a couple specific, first scientific. Let me address the scientific, Senator Olson, that you brought up. There are scientific studies on both sides. And if you'd been here in the last session through SB 80, we've had 30,000 on global warming one side and 30,000 on the other. One of the reasons this has been banned in other places is the precautionary measure, which I know multiple scientists have come in and talked about that. And interestingly enough, one of the other reasons to address your question is that the nine major manufacturers of these products in the United States have recognized the precautionary measure. They also recognize that we are a very litigative society. I'm even in possession of a very long, lengthy legal document provided by a member of this committee, in which if it were anywhere close to true, they'd be suing these nine manufacturers. The problem we face right now is we have nine major manufacturers and 12 major retailers, all of them operating inside the state of Oregon, all of them creating jobs inside the state of Oregon. And what has transpired is they've done the right thing. As you well know, the Food and Drug Administration recommendation does say that they support all of these manufacturers removing these three products from the market. What has transpired, though, while these people who employ Oregonians are doing the right thing, there is a small market niche that has been created by that, and those people are coming in from outside of the state and putting this product onto our streets. And so rather than punish bad behavior in terms of those people who are working in the state of Oregon, what we're attempting to do here is identify the good behavior that's there, protect citizens in the precautionary measure, which even all of the industry behind the scenes will tell you that is an acceptable scientific measure, and protect those individuals so that we take action now. We could take absolutely no action, and then what transpires is we're rewarding bad behavior, and we're missing the opportunity to put more Oregonians to work when it comes to the labeling piece. When I say Oregonians, they're in my district.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Senator, the constraints that you put on are one part per billion, or one-tenth of a part per billion? Is that measurable?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, not only is it measurable, you have nine major manufacturing companies, including Advent, Born Free Diesel, Brown, Evenflow, Gerber, Playtex, and everybody else, who are already labeling BPA free, which means intentionally, not intentionally added, and they are measuring those today. The interesting thing that does come out of here is there are some industries, for example, in Oregon, that don't have the capability, say in the pulp and paper, because it's a different type of product. But it's also a standard, strangely enough, 1 billionth. I couldn't fathom that myself until the Federal Reserve got to $1.7 trillion in printing money. And so, I mean, it is a standard that is out there. It's a scientific standard. I have even asked members of industry, scientific members who have been to your office too, is this really the standard? Because I scratched my head when you raised this issue before and said maybe it should be 1 millionth. But then I got educated by industry that, oh, no, it is, but don't say that.
Follow up. In lieu of banning a product, would, since this is an important issue that science really hasn't settled down on yet, wouldn't it be just as appropriate to just educate folks to say, you know, stay away from this product? And if they stay away from it, that would alleviate your theory of low-cost people coming in and selling product that isn't BPA-free.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's true if you have a checkbook. And I don't think the state of Oregon's in a position to pay for the educational process. We also have, you know, a responsibility when we do see prudency to take a prudent action. I am not a supporter, as the good chair knows, of the nanny state concept. I happened to look at this one, looked at it last time. We said we'll take a year off, a hiatus, review it. And then when we came up with the present plan that we have on, right now, which is very close to the minority report, and let me address that, because that, if you wouldn't mind, I'm sure, because that may come up. The original minority report, the difference here other than the labeling standard from the past, of which I will say 12 Republicans voted for the minority report the last time around, is the FDA piece. And it comes down to the FDA either passes a regulation, which is unclear legally even by the FDA whether they can, or whether that is a recommendation. And as you know, the January 2010 report from the Food and Drug Administration does recommend and agree with removing these specific products. And if you look at the list of individuals, again, that have done this, the best thing for us is to back up what industry has done for once instead of over-regulate them, and then provide them a market incentive through the label to increase the rate of return to products coming out of the state of Oregon upwards of 40%.
One final question.
Since BPA is so prevalent in everything we have and use, even if we eliminate it from sippy cups and baby bottles, how do we prevent babies from still ingesting the product unless we ban everything with BPA in it?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we can't save everybody in terms of BPA. You're absolutely correct. Here's what we can, though. I've had 6 kids. Every one of them's had a sippy cup. Every one of them's had a baby bottle. Unlike you and I, who have a choice to go out and get fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, so on and so forth, we're kind of restricted, especially in the 21st century. We're all in here working. There's people in this room who have children and infants, and they don't have time to go out and do all the fresh things that they need to eliminate BPA in their diet. What we've created ourselves, including through a tax system that came from Democrats and Republicans, is a society in which we're always in a rush, and we have to take care of their children the best way we can. If they had a choice, you're right, but when you're a toddler crawling around on the floor, or you're the 3-year-old from somebody in this room, you don't have that choice. So what we're trying to do is do the best thing we can with the resources we have and take care of our children while helping the parents and creating working jobs here in the community.
One more.
I was going to say that was the final question.
But he brought up a good point in the fact that the toddler is crawling on the floor, which contains BPA. The toddler plays with toys that contain BPA. It's a process where it's everywhere, and if we, this minute little bit they could get out of the sippy cup could be overwhelmed by what they get crawling across the floor and chewing on the dog's bone.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, my children didn't eat off the carpet.
They did crawl on it.
They did crawl on it, but they didn't put fingers in their mouth.
Okay, so Senator, it sounds like that you might want to broaden the scope of the bill to include other products.
Yeah.
We will entertain other amendments if you have them. With that, are there any other questions for the good senator? No. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Olson.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
With that, I will entertain a motion. We are in a work session, aren't we?
Yep. Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 8 into Senate Bill 695.
Okay. Senator Prezonsky moves to adopt the dash 8 amendments dated 3/22/2011. Is that right? Yep. Is there any discussion? Senator Thompson. Is there a discussion on the amendment?
This is a discussion on the thing.
No, this is just adopting the amendment.
Yeah, this is adopting the amendment, and then we'll take a vote on that, and then we'll have another opportunity for discussion on the entire bill.
Okay.
Yeah. But since it's a gut and stuff, if you want to talk about the amendment, you could. Okay. So no discussion on the amendment. Are there any objections?
Yes.
Okay. So noted, Senator Olson. Okay. I'll take another motion.
Well, first you got to affirm what you just did.
Yes. So we've adopted the dash 8 into Senate Bill 695 with
Madam
one
Chair.
Objection. Senator Olson, so noted.
Madam Chair, I now move Senate Bill 695 as amended by the dash 8 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
OK, Okay, Senator Przanski has moved Senate Bill 695 as amended with the dash 8s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Senator Thompson?
Yes, I would like to discuss my opinion and my vote on this. I'm going to be a no vote, not because I don't believe this is a good bill to do the BPA free with sippy cups and baby bottles. I support that part of it. I'm going to be a no vote just because I just want to be a voice. I see this passing, but I want to be the voice that says that our canned food products in Oregon are safe. Just a note out to the public, the FDA hasn't confirmed that this is good or bad, and I don't want to send any panic out there. And just want to say that I think this will get there eventually. I think it's market driven already. You can go to Walmart and buy sippy cups of Safeway, several stores now, and do the same thing. And I'd like to just see it done in the marketplace. And I think it's happening at this time. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Any other comments?
Yes. Oh, go ahead.
Senator Hess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support this, and I very much want to thank you and Senator Boquist for being careful and detailed. I know this came up in the last session. There's been a lot of work since then, and it's been, I think, very thoughtful in getting the people together to come up with a rather well-crafted piece of legislation that addresses a lot of the concerns that have come up since we took a swing at this last year. And so my hat's off to both you and Senator Boquist and everyone else who participated in this.
Great. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Yes, I, as you know, I will be a no vote on this, but I'm coming from a little different aspect. I also agree with Senator Thompson that this is important for the children, and certainly we don't want any chemicals or anything like that that can hurt our infants because they're our future. But I come at it from the standpoint that if we ban these products and put on there that they're BPA-free, we give a negative connotation to the consumers that if it's not BPA-free, then it's going to be harmful to us. And we know from studies, whether it be 30,000 on each side or whatever, that there are numerous questions as to the total effect of BPA on human beings. And so I'm a no. I like the concept of the sippy cups and the baby bottles. I really do. But it bothers me that now if someone says your ballpoint pen isn't BPA free, that you know it's going to be harmful to you. And so it broadens. It's a whole new world out there of what's good for us and what's not. So I will be a no on this.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Olson. With that, why don't we call the roll for this? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Przanski.
That's fine. I just want to clarify. I heard Senator Thompson say something about metal cans. I just want to, on the record for my review of the summary, that the provisions that related to metal cans has been removed.
That's correct.
It is not currently in the dash 8s, and so just to let you know that.
Yeah.
And put that
thank
on the record.
You.
Great. Thank
just
you.
Philosophy.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks.
Any other comments? All right. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Haas?
Aye.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Chair Dinkfelder?
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and carriers will be the chair, and Senator Boquist will co-carry the bill. So with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 695. Now we're going to move on to a public hearing on Senate Bill 945. Let Beth catch up, and then I'm going to say a few words.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 945, you should have a dash 3 amendment in front of you, which is also a gut and stuff amendment, so it is now the bill. So I'll briefly go over what is in the bill. Senate Bill 945-3 would prohibit, effective July 1st, 2014, the sale or offering for sale brake friction material or motor vehicles or trailers with brake friction material containing certain levels of fibers or elements. The bill exempts motor vehicles or trailers previously sold at retail or manufactured before July 1st, 2014. There are also additional exemptions in the bill. The bill goes on to add copper at the level of 5% to the prohibited elements as of January 1st, 2021. and it directs DEQ to the extent practicable to consult and coordinate with other states to achieve interstate consistency, and also to watch the Brake Friction Material Advisory Committee in the state of Washington. Once it has found that alternative brake friction material, which means material with copper at a level of 0.5%, is available, to make a report to an appropriate legislative committee.
Okay, thank you, Beth. I'm going to say a few words on this bill. For committee members that are here during the interim, we did have interim hearings on this, but for the new folks, just give you a little bit of background, and then I think we have Noah Fisheries, who's going to come up first and share some of the information that I learned about and was the reason that this bill came forward. So Jen McIntyre, do you want to come up? Because I know you have to get your presentation up and going. So, but the reason that this bill is before you, for two reasons, I was concerned about when I learned about the impacts of copper on certain species, in mainly affecting salmon. And many of you know I've worked for many, many years in the state on salmon recovery as a former watershed coordinator and also with an organization working on salmon restoration habitat. What I found out was heavy metals such as copper directly damage the sensory capabilities of salmon. You're going to see some of that, making them vulnerable to predators and preventing them from successfully finding their way back to spawning grounds. One of the things that we're doing here in the state of Oregon, similar to the state of Washington and the state of California, which, by the way, the states of Washington and California have already passed legislation that we're going to hear today, similar to what we're going to hear today. We're spending millions and millions of dollars on recovering our salmon stocks in the state. And one of the reasons I brought this forward is because this is one preventative things that we can do to make sure that the money that we're investing is not going to waste. We want to make sure that the salmon habitat, that we're restoring the salmon stocks that we're trying to recover, have the best chance that they can. So prior to drafting this legislation, the committee staff and I put together a work group that I've lost track, but I think we were up to 25 people on the work group. And this bill is the result of that. We addressed many, many of the issues that came forward. But you're going to see some information from NOAA Fisheries about what the problem is and what we're trying to address. So with that, I really appreciate you coming down from Seattle today, I think you did, to share this with us. And I think we're going to hear from some other folks as well. But thank you very much. And just if you can state your name for the record.
All right. Checking the volume on this microphone.
Yeah, you're okay.
All right. My name is Jennifer McIntyre, and I'm representing here today NOAA Fisheries. And I'm going to briefly summarize our research on the sublethal effect of copper's neurotoxicity to juvenile coho salmon. Let's see how this proceeds. All right, so the reason that we study copper is that it is among several metals that are very common pollutants in aquatic systems. In urban or urbanizing areas, the two largest sources of copper, two watersheds, are pesticides and then the dust from brake pads. And most of that copper is entering waterways from stormwater runoff. Now, at the concentrations found in stormwater runoff, copper is not outright killing the fish, but we know that at very low concentrations, copper is neurotoxic. And in fish, the most sensitive endpoint is going to be sensory neurons in the peripheral sensory system. So this is where in fish there are neurons directly exposed to the water. These include sensory neurons that control taste, smell, which is also called olfaction, and mechanosensation. You may have seen on the side of a fish there's a line, and in that line are some of these sensory neurons that detect motion in the water around the fish. So the picture on the left here, I'm showing some white hair cells, they're called, and those are the sensory neurons of that lateral line mechanosensation system. And the picture on the right, this is a fish with you're zoomed very close in here, and you can see that there are none of those hair cells are present anymore, and this was after a few hours exposure to a copper concentration that's a little higher than you might usually see in stormwater, but it's a strong example of how very destructive copper can be to neurons. Now, we know a lot about copper's effect on olfaction, even relative to that mechanosensory system. So fish do, in fact, have nostrils, and inside there are these delicate organs that are covered by sensory neurons. And those allow fish to detect chemicals that allow them to smell, much like our sensory system works for smell. There is a long history of spanning 40 years looking at copper neurotoxicity in a variety of animals, including fish. So the reason that olfactory toxicity becomes important is that fish, especially salmon, use smell cues for a lot of behaviors that are important to their survival and their fitness, their ability to reproduce and create the next generation. So, for example, behaviors that have an olfactory component include salmon finding their way home. They include reproductive priming and some of the spawning behaviors, the timing of egg hatching, the timing of emergence from the gravel, their ability to imprint and learn the smell of their home stream so that they can return and spawn. And the specific behavior that we have focused on in our research program is one that helps them avoid predation as when they're juveniles rearing in freshwater. And that's that pink arc on the bottom of the diagram of their life cycle. There's an alarm cue present in fish skin. It's called Schreckstoff, which is a German word literally meaning scary stuff. And it's released by mechanical damage to fish skin. And originally this is an animation which would just show happy fish swimming around. One of them gets attacked by a predator. This purple cloud is there to represent this alarm cue dispersing in the water. And then when they detect that alarm cue, they have this innate response, which is to literally freeze, and they sink to the bottom. And I'm going to show three videos now, and the first one will demonstrate this behavior. It will.
Let's hope it works.
It worked well when we practiced it earlier.
It did. I saw it.
It's a little slower right now for some reason. Okay, so we should have taken it off the USB drive, I think. I apologize for the delays. It'll be worth it, though.
I've seen it before. It is worth it.
Wow. So I may play this twice because it's already started on its own. But the top view is a tank where there's it's two different views of one tank where there's a control fish, so a fish not exposed to copper. And in the bottom, you see two views of a tank where a fish has been exposed to a low concentration of copper, like you might find in a stream impacted by stormwater, for just 3 hours, which is a relatively brief exposure. I'm going to play that again. There's a point when skin extract is added to the tank, that Schreckstoff skin extract. So right now the video's sped up and they're bopping around feeding on things in the water column. That, do you see how the top fish now has stopped moving and sunk to the bottom of the tank? That is because the skin extract was added to the water and they're responding to that with the innate alarm behavior. That copper-exposed fish continues to swim around as if it didn't smell anything, which in fact is the case. See if I can get. I'll skip the second video in the interests of time. We then proceeded to do a number of. Let's see, here it is. Of predation experiments because, okay, this behavior is being impacted by copper, but what's going to happen if they're actually in the presence of predators and under attack? So that inside the circle, there's a fish that is, in fact, frozen. It's displaying that alarm behavior, and at some point, it will either decide maybe it's safe or, like, it can't spend all day being frozen. But the predators are paying no attention to it, and this is because most of the predators of juvenile salmon, and a lot of fishes, in fact, are cued by motion. They're very much, they notice when things move. It makes me think of the Jurassic Park movie where they're like, if you don't move, it can't see you. So when that circle disappeared, the fish moved, and then it was attacked by the predators. So I've just I have a summary slide. I didn't think you'd want to see all of the graphs from the research with the predators. Oops. Sorry.
I know, the laptops are ancient. She's sitting there going, Sue, do you want to help her while she's...
There, okay.
Got it.
So this is the last slide, so I meant to jump right to it. So just to summarize the way that copper... Oh, geez. Thanks. Thank you.
Maybe Sue can be doing this while she's talking.
Close. Thanks. There we go. All right. So we definitely found that copper altered predator-prey dynamics when you had the two interacting. We found that juvenile coho exposed to copper showed a reduced or completely eliminated olfactory ability when we measured this electrophysiologically, which I didn't show. We found that they could not detect if there was a predator upstream. Usually they'll respond behaviorally, even if they just smell in the water that there's a predator upstream, and they did not do this. They were easier for predators to detect, and this is because they didn't display this alarm behavior, even at the lowest copper concentration that we tested. They were also easier for the predators to catch. More of the first, and if you saw that video, the predator had to attack two or three times before it actually caught the fish. But when prey had been exposed to copper, more of those first attacks were actually successful. They didn't have to keep chasing them down. And they also overall captured them faster if they'd been exposed to copper. And then finally, I just want to note that even when the predators had also been exposed to copper, we found these differences to be true. And I think that's all I have to show. And if there's time and you want to, I could try answering questions.
Okay. I think we will do that. And then I know that the Department of Environmental Quality wants to come up as well. Can you talk a little bit about some of the studies? I've been asked by colleagues, you know, as it's been studied. Can you talk a little bit about this? And obviously this is the results of the studies that you've done, but a little more detail about how well this issue has been studied.
Which issue do you mean? Do you mean the olfactory toxicity or the behavioral response to that toxicity?
Yes, the latter. And the effect of copper on those behaviors.
It's actually been fairly well studied. We are the first group that focused on coho salmon, but like I said, there's 40 years of studies on copper's olfactory neurotoxicity, and perhaps the oldest studies on the actual behaviors associated with that are you know, equally 20 or 30 years old. They include, a whole variety of different classes of fishes, not just salmon. A lot of fishes as juveniles display this anti-predator freezing behavior. And there are a variety of studies that have shown that various metals, not only copper, affect their ability to display that behavior. Let's see, anything else?
Okay. We'll see if there's any other questions from the panel.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
You have a question? Senator Olson.
On your slide that you gave that show, you said that low concentrations of copper were put into the test pool. What were the concentrations?
So there, I showed a few different experiments there. The one that was a tank experiment with just the fish by itself, mm-hmm. just to show the impact of copper on the behavior itself, I believe they went down, they may have gone down as low as 2 parts per billion, 2 micrograms per liter of copper. In the research that was with the predators, and that was my dissertation work, actually, I used 5 micrograms per liter as the lowest concentration, and that was, you know, certainly there's a threshold somewhere between 0 and and 5 where you would not see an effect, but that's just the lowest concentration I tested.
Follow it.
When you look at Wikipedia, it says that copper is an essential trace element that is vital to the health of all living things.
Certainly true.
Okay, question being then, in the marine industry, do you know what they make propellers out of? A lot of propellers are made out of bronze, which includes copper.
Right.
If we do away with brake
pads. How do we resolve the issue of A, copper that is used in marine industry traditionally, and B, when you have copper water pipes in your house, runs through and goes into the septic system, sewage system, and runs out, and I don't know that the septic or the sewage plants treat for copper. How do we eliminate that problem?
I see that as a separate problem, and this isn't the focus of our research. Our research is what I showed today, but if you want me to try to speak a little bit to it. Our specific concern has to do with where juvenile salmon are rearing in freshwater habitats, because that's where the copper from in the stormwater runoff is going to be having its impact, is going to be most concentrated. You know, by the time it's reaching the estuaries and then the larger sound and the oceans, you're going to have a huge dilutionary effect. In marinas, I know there are elevated copper concentrations that people are concerned about, but this specifically, I think, is a good... I really shouldn't say whether I think it's a good measure because I'm here to talk about the science, but... I think it will do a good job at reducing, at being a source control for copper that's going to impact juvenile salmon in the year that they rear in freshwater habitats.
One follow-up.
Yep.
On your study with the fish in the tank that the predators were in, I would have probably put in more credence to that if there was some type of structure that a typical small smolt would lay by and hide. Once he's out in the open, any movement is going to attract a predator fish.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, fish... will not be out in the open to have a predator eat them. I mean, that's just instinctive. It's built in. So in your testing, had you laid out some form of structure that fish could have laid by, he might have laid there for 2 or 3 days and never got eaten.
I'd like to address that, if I may.
Good. That's what I'm asking.
I tried various...
PhD on this.
I tried various structures, and they weren't so much interested in the structure. I mean, their primary defense is to freeze whether or not there's structure around, and the reason for that is that, you know, if the control fish were relatively easy to see here because they were also an object in a tank that didn't have a lot in it. So if you imagine fish in the wild, that control fish that wasn't exposed to copper, when it's frozen down, I mean, you really cannot see that fish. So that's why the motion is even more important. In the experiments, when I had structure in there, they didn't particularly use it. They just did the hunkering down thing. And I ended up, I don't know if you could tell in that tank, I had a bunch of little rocks that looked like juvenile fish, and I even saw a predator attack one of those rocks once, thinking, "Oh, there's the fish! I know there's a fish in here. I've been trained to to know that there's a fish in here somewhere." So, a lot of the measures that I used in these experiments, even though it's an artificial setup, do lead to a conservative result.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions? Thank you very much for sharing that information and. There may be some other questions if you can stick around.
Do you want me to
stay
here?
No, you can sit back there, and then we'll have some other people up. And if there's some other questions, we'll call you back up.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Thank you for driving down and waiting.
Yeah, thank you. It's probably nice to know that people are caring about your research, though. Palmer, why don't you come up? I'd asked the department to come up and.
Oh, DEQ, all right.
I think the League of Oregon Cities is going to talk about why this is important for them. Welcome, Palmer.
For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Thanks for having me here. I wanted to talk a little bit about why DEQ supports Senate Bill 945. We support the bill because it deals with a number of heavy metals that are pollutants. Of priority pollutants for our agency-wide toxic reduction strategy. Those include copper, zinc, chromium, cadmium, and lead. And there are water bodies in Oregon that have been designated impaired both for copper and lead because of exceedances of water quality criteria. And when we say waters have been impaired, that means they've been identified on the 303D list as impaired for the designated use of that water body. Some examples of water bodies like that include Amazon Creek in Eugene, Pringle Creek in Salmon, and the Knoll Wetland that feeds into Fano Creek in Beaverton. There's been a lot of talk about the effect of copper, particularly copper from brake pads, on salmon. You just saw the presentation by Ms. McIntyre, and it does point out the fact that even the effects and the adverse effects on salmon at relatively low levels in surface waters. What I want to also share with you and what was passed out by committee staff is a graph that shows detections of copper in the Willamette Basin here in Oregon. And if I can, let me walk you through that graph. So what you see here is concentrations of milligrams per liter of copper. And these are detections of copper by water sampling at water sampling sites. And so we have two sets of a dark box. The dark box, the entire dark box, represents where 50% of the detections were noted, of the concentrations of copper. So 25% are above that dark box, and then 25% are below. And then you'll see a dashed line there. That represents what is generally considered the safe benchmark level for concentrations of copper in surface waters. And Ms. McIntyre mentioned that it was about that point of about 5 milligrams per liter that you start to see adverse effects on aquatic life. And then the other thing I'd like to point out about this graph is it ties back to the detections of copper based on of traffic volumes. And so you see two sets of columns here, essentially, where you have a daily traffic count of less than 1,000 vehicles a day, and then you have a traffic count of greater than 1,000 vehicles a day. And when you look at this, I think you can see that where you have higher traffic volumes, you see a relatively substantial jump in the exceedances, or excuse me, the detections of copper above that benchmark. And while this is not as definitive as the study that NOAA did in San Francisco Bay, where they actually determine the pollutant loadings from the sources, including from brake pads, I think this is a pretty strong correlation to show that, again, where we have high traffic volumes near a waterway, you tend to see more copper in that waterway. And again, this is Oregon-based data that was collected over a period from 1991 to 2008. And I did want to talk a minute about the San Francisco Bay study, and I think that study, if I recall correctly, was presented to this committee over the interim. That was one of the discussions that the folks from NOAA brought up. And what they determined there in San Francisco Bay is that 36% of the copper released from human activity into that watershed were released from copper breaks. It's not to say that copper breaks are the only source of copper. That certainly is not the case, but that they were 36%, excuse me, of the copper going into the water from urban stormwater in San Francisco Bay. The other large source, just so it's noted for the record, was the copper that comes from copper-based pesticides. Those are often pesticides that are used to help treat wood to prevent rot and that type of thing. There are, of course, other sources of copper in the environment. But I think all this shows that there is a need to address copper loading into Oregon surface waters to protect our aquatic life. And we think Senate Bill 945 does that in a particularly effective way because it focuses on the copper at its source, in this case the brake pads, rather than trying to control copper at the point of release or discharge or where it's already in the environment. That tends to be a much more expensive way to try to manage copper once it's already been released. And it's generally more effective, at least we believe so, to try and deal with a toxic pollutant at its source. So for those reasons, we're supporting Senate Bill 945.
Thank you, Palmer. Questions?
Yes,
yeah.
I just have
Senator Thompson.
Senator Ding, Chairman Dingfelder, thank you. The report says no revenue impact statement has been issued. Have you done a study on what you'll have to do for this?
All right. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, we have been evaluating the fiscal impact of this bill, and I can tell you there will be a fiscal impact to the department. We haven't determined the exact level yet, but given that this is a program that's pretty large in scale and that it affects brake pads and vehicles around the state of Oregon, we think the fiscal will be relatively modest. But that's sort of where we are. We're trying to determine, is it modest enough to be at a minimal level or not, and we haven't made that determination yet. I will note that the chair, going through the work group, has made a number of changes in the bill that have helped over time to reduce the fiscal impact to DUQ, but there will be ultimately some level of fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Palmer, thank you very much for coming. Are you fully invested in the San Francisco study, and by that I mean, do you know how they determined that 36% of the released copper came from brakes?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, Mrs. McIntyre may be the best person to speak to that, but my understanding is that they ultimately had to use modeling to determine where they thought the copper came from. But my understanding is that was, of course, a peer-reviewed study and has generally been pretty widely accepted. But that is my understanding. I can certainly get you more information about the quality or the integrity of that study, if that's what you're asking.
Well, it is, because one of the points that I asked earlier was the fact that marine uses copper quite heavily. And if you do a sample in a place like San Francisco Bay that has a huge, huge proportion of ships, I don't know how the science could accurately determine that 36% came from copper brakes.
Right. Chair Ding, fellow Senator Olson, why don't I do this? I'll try to get more information about how they reached those conclusions, and I'll certainly follow up on that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Palmer? Okay. Thank you. And I was going to ask Jen, I don't know how familiar you are with the San Francisco study. Yeah. If you have an answer.
Poor lady.
Yeah.
Yo-yo.
And just say your name for the record again, please.
Right. Jennifer McIntyre, again, from NOAA Fisheries. I'm familiar with that study, not in enough detail to answer your question about the ship component, the boat component, or the, you know, it's not just propellers, brass propellers. I mean, it's anti-fouling paint on the bottom of boats. It's a lot of sources in marina-type environments. But I'm pretty sure they included that. And it just, to me, it does highlight that the relative importance of, you know, a source like brake pads to a watershed. I mean, you look at the number of the car density in an area like San Francisco Bay, and every single time we tap our brakes, a little bit of dust is coming off. It's either washing into the waters directly, or it's getting blown up in really fine particulate dust and then rained down or blown down into those watersheds. I did want to use this as an opportunity to answer your micronutrient question about copper is an essential nutrient for all life, and the difference is that it's at incredibly tiny concentrations that we require it in our bodies, and the concentrations that are neurotoxic are just that much higher, like in orders of magnitude higher, which is still just a tiny bit, and it's the micrograms per liter. I think I didn't get a chance to look at that graph, but it's micrograms per liter that are having the neurotoxic impacts.
Great. Thank you very much for coming back up. Okay. Now we're going to take testimony off the sign-up sheet. So I have Daryl Fuller. Is Daryl here? Okay. No Daryl. Tom Wolf. Sue Marshall. Sue. And Jim Myron, I guess. Okay. Maybe people got scared away by the chickens. Yeah.
I think Tom submitted written testimony.
Okay. Did Tom submit written testimony? Okay.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing the Oregon Chapter of American Fisheries Society. Just by way of a little background, the American Fisheries Society is the world's the world's oldest and largest organization dedicated to strengthening fisheries and aquatic resources. The Oregon chapter of the American Fisheries Society was established in 1964 and is comprised of over 450 aquatic and fisheries scientists, professionals from federal, state, and tribal agencies, colleges, and universities, and diverse private employers. Attached to the cover letter is the Oregon chapter's most recent background paper on heavy metals, including copper. And I will let you be able to look at that. And there's also several sites of studies and papers on the issue. Heavy metals, including copper, can negatively impact important aquatic organisms, including salmon, steelhead, sturgeon, and lamprey, by affecting a number of the essential processes like respiration, fitness, migration, and reproduction. Just to call out a few things in the paper related to copper, as was mentioned, heavy metals are naturally occurring. However, with human activity, these substances can increase and can concentrate the conduit for heavy metals, including copper, into aquatic habitats from sources related to automobiles is via roads and urban storm water. Copper has been found to be harmful to salmon at levels as low as 2 parts per billion. These concentrations are much lower than currently accepted for human consumption. SB 945 is consistent with the Oregon chapter's position related to heavy metals because it minimizes the use of heavy metals that are contained in materials and products that have a potential to enter waterways. This includes brake pads. We're happy to provide you with any additional assistance with this legislation or any other legislation related to heavy metals. Thank you very much for bringing this issue forward and for your consideration.
Great. Thank you, Sue. Jim?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. I had participated in a few of the most recent meetings of the work group, and I'm here just simply to put the Native Fish Society on record in support of this bill. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of the panelists?
Yeah, of course, you know I have one. I always have a question. Do we have any documented cases of our coho going up the Deschutes instead of up the Saint, up the Johns,
up
a different river? In other words, do we have any documented cases of our fish having problem?
I was going to say, we now have Tom Wolf with Trout Unlimited, too, that might be able to answer this question. But
Well, Chair Dingfelder, Representative Olson, Senator Olson, yes. I'm not aware of any, but I certainly can follow up on that and get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
And Tom, can you state your name for the record? And if you want to say a few words, we'd call you up and you're out in the hall boarding or something.
No, Chair Dingfelder, committee members, I was actually, this is a day I call a twofer. There's another committee, there's another bill in another committee in the House Environment Committee at the exact same time. And, you know, I secretly
think. Well, you know the Senate's more important.
Yeah, well, oh, I thought so too, but, you know. The other one is something I also feel passionately about. So I just real quickly, we support Senate Bill 945. I was at a American Fisheries Society seminar on urban salmon in the fall, and one of the topics during the seminar was copper and salmon. And I won't repeat what the woman with NOAA said. It's the exact same things, but copper has a major nasty effect on salmon, on their olfactory senses, on their ability to freeze, and the primary cause of that, of course, is copper leaking out from breaks. So we must do something to get copper and other heavy metals out of breaks. So I think that Senate Bill 945 is the right step, and I support, our organization supports it wholeheartedly.
Okay. And I my sense is we'll have to get back to you on that one. I mean, on your question, because I don't think
I have a follow-up question if I can ask it.
Sure.
We seem to always, in our new technological age, kind of pinpoint down on some specific item that we always have to have something that's bad and something's the cause of it. Copper is everywhere.
We have copper roofs downtown Portland that drain onto the streets, drain into the stormwater system. Are we going to end up having to remove all copper from everywhere? I mean, right now we're looking at breaks. At what point do we say we can't do anything because we have to go back to the Stone Age because we can't have technology?
Well, I'll attempt to answer that question. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, that's a good question. I don't have a good answer. I mean, you're right, copper is everything, everywhere. And maybe we can't get it. Maybe we have to let it stay in certain areas, but it's been shown that we can get to it with the brake pad. That's something we can do. Maybe, you know, and you're right that it's tough to deal with everything, but I just want to focus on this one particular thing that we can go after copper here, and I don't have any knowledge one way or the other about what we can do about the other stuff. Maybe we just have to let the other stuff go, but we can do something about copper and brake pads.
I will first try to answer the question since the chair worked on this bill and had a work group. And I think NOAA Fisheries can probably also try to answer. But part of the challenge or the problem with brake pads is that every time you step on the brake, a little bit of dust is coming off those brake pads, unlike a copper roof where, I mean, it's not really going anywhere. You know, it's there. I mean, that's part of the problem here. I think that's why copper brake pads have been targeted as an issue, especially near waterways. I don't know if NOAA would like to come up and add anything, or do I get that right?
We were just discussing that.
Yeah, so I think that's...
Then I do have a follow-up. Since we're worried about copper brake pads near waterways, I would probably say that a majority of Oregonians that drive don't live near a waterway. A majority of people that live in Wyoming don't have salmon. And this bill essentially will change the way brake pads are used around the United States.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, just to respond a bit to your previous question, I think as we learn more, we can do a better job. And then when it comes to protecting the environment that we've adaptively managed as we've learned that where there's problems and to do things differently. And within Oregon, where there are roads and where there is a wet season and where there are cars, those roads become the conduit for water that runs off those surfaces directly into streams. It's an urban stormwater problem, and this bill is an attempt to provide an upstream solution, if you will, to a problem that a number of municipalities and special districts are grappling with.
Okay. And I will add, as a former watershed coordinator, I think almost every single stream that we were working on had a road nearby, just about, it seems like. And, of course, and that's where we put a lot of our roads because that was the easiest path of least resistance along our floodplains.
Madam Chair, my point being that this bill that we're dealing with in Oregon is going to affect the entire United States, and most of the United States doesn't have salmon growing in it.
Well, I'm actually going to excuse this panel, and I'm going to ask the industry to come up because I think the industry is going to talk about what they're doing to address bills in Washington and California that's already requiring this. So I'm going to call up Nelson Garcia and Frank Oliver. Senator Hass, did you want to say something?
I was going to say, I don't know if this was in the summary, but does California already have?
Yep, they're going to talk about that. California and Washington have already adopted this, and they're going to talk about what they're doing to comply with those states. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming from Washington, D.C.
Yes, ma'am.
And
how do you like our weather?
As you can see, it rains a lot here.
It does.
So the issue around brakes is an important issue here. Well, so, gentlemen, thank you for coming here. Welcome, and if you can state your name for the record, please.
Sure. Let me actually start first, Madam Chair. My name is Nelson Garcia. I'm the Director of Federal and State Policy for the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association. I'm personally based out of Washington, D.C. Our trade association represents the automotive and heavy-duty parts suppliers and manufacturers, as well as remanufacturers here in the United States. I represent about 600 companies. Directly, we employ about 686,000 people as an industry. But if you factor in other entities that provide us with services, such as insurance, banking, and other human resources, the number actually jumps up to another 3.2 million people. So we are considered still the largest manufacturing industry in the United States, even with all the challenges that the industry has faced over the past 3 or 4 years. We're proud to say that we have maintained that status as the biggest manufacturing industry in the United States. In the state of Oregon, we directly employ about 3,740 people from the membership that we have in the state of Oregon. I was honored to have testified in front of the committee back in December, so I really don't have anything to add from that testimony, other than to say that I wanted to thank the chair, as well as Beth Petrino, for being extremely generous and kind and open and accessible to our member companies, as well as to MEMA as a whole. You folks have done a marvelous job in trying to accept many of our changes, requests to change the bill to match up and be consistent with Washington and, in some ways, California. And I'm here to actually answer any questions that you may have after the testimony of Mr. Oliveto, who's going to speak on behalf of MEMA, but as well as the Brake Manufacturers Council and the other affiliates that we have involved in this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Frank Oliveto, and I'm from Detroit, Michigan area, so... Okay, I'm head of industry relations for Advix North America, and Advix is a world-class brake system supplier which provides high-quality brake systems and components to the global marketplace. And I'll skip a few things that you already discussed about our affiliations, but AASA represents the North American aftermarket supplier industry and is recognized as one of the nation's strongest and most prominent trade organizations with more than 100 years of experience. I'd like to first of all thank you for holding this important informational hearing. I would also like to express our sincere appreciation to your staff for reaching out to our industry to further discuss our views and concerns regarding the reduction of copper in brake pads. The BMC, MEMA, and AASA have been active in the collaborative efforts among stakeholders to reduce copper in brake pads. These effects have created a fair and balanced approach that simultaneously addresses the environmental needs of the state while protecting the economic viability of our industry. As a result of the California and Washington laws, the industry will be required to meet strict deadlines to eliminate copper and brake friction materials that will impact all 50 states. Both laws prohibit 5 specific minerals from being sold into both states by 2014. By 2021, no brake friction material can be sold in both states that contain more than 5% copper and its compounds by weight. By 2025, California bans brake friction material that exceeds 0.5% copper by weight from being sold in that state. Washington also bans the sale of brake friction materials exceeding 0.5% copper by weight once a proven and safe alternative replacement is identified. Therefore, the BMC, MEMA, and AASA strongly believe that the need for additional legislation in Oregon, as well as other states, is no longer necessary with the passage of copper mitigation legislation in California and Washington State. For business efficiency and cost effectiveness, the industry as a whole will reformulate brake friction materials that are free of copper, not just for California and Washington markets, but for the entire country. Okay. We believe that the introduction of similar legislation will only result in unnecessary and costly administrative burdens for our industry and for your state at a time of tight budgetary restraints. Overall, the brake manufacturing industry will be investing a tremendous amount of resources in meeting the requirements of California and Washington laws, necessitating a multi-year reformulation process for each brake friction material. The 8 original equipment major brake friction material suppliers, each owning 25 to 35 registered brake friction formulations, will need to reformulate the vast majority of their products in order to meet the 0.5% copper requirements. This calculates anywhere between 200 to 200 different friction reformulations by 2021. This does not take in consideration the other 70-plus brake friction manufacturing companies who supply the aftermarket industry. The average total cost to develop just one new formulation is about $450,000. Multiply that against the 280 registered formulations, and additional research and development costs for our industry alone could anywhere be between $90 and $130 million. Brake friction material is not a one-size-fits-all product. Disc pads, rotors, calipers, and tires are designed to take into consideration the various stopping needs of light-duty passenger and heavy-duty vehicles. Once again, that due to the reformulation requirements of the California and Washington laws, the industry will develop new copper-free brake materials which would cover the national market, and the need to introduce this legislation is totally not necessary. There's no going back for our industry as far as what we're doing as far as eliminating brake pad, copper in brake pads. The MEMA, BMC, and ASA continue to look forward to working with you and your staff and on this very important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. First of all, I just want to thank you gentlemen for coming here today. And we have to clarify one thing. It's Oregon. We have this little problem with people that come from different places. We're very sensitive about it. It's Oregon and Willamette. So that's the lesson for the day.
But, thank you.
Anyway, in all seriousness, I appreciate your testimony. I want to make a couple of comments. First of all, I want to thank your industry for stepping up and saying this is going to happen, obviously, because California and Washington are leading the way, and we're trying to have consistent standards on the West Coast, as we discussed, I think, in December when we had the hearing last time. The main reason that that we've worked on this, and as you mentioned, you know, I think we've done a good job at addressing the concerns in the work group. We had a voluminous work group, and we'll make sure that the list gets out to the committee members again, especially for the new folks. And we did attempt to address the concerns. What I had heard last time is, you know, we like the Washington bill better. We're going to have to deal with California, but it makes a lot more sense. So what we've done is crafted a bill that's pretty similar. I can't say identical because our laws are different to Washington, including the type of, you know, testing requirements. We're very much working closely with Washington. So the concern that I had and why, you know, I brought this bill forward was, because, you know, we want to have consistent standards, send a message nationally, which is something that I know you guys don't want to deal with in every state. We've had this conversation. And similar to other bills that we've passed, the federal government is not taking the lead. The states are. And so we're trying to send a message to the federal government that we hope that the federal government does address brake pads at the national level, because it's going to make you guys' life easier. However, in the absence of that, the states are stepping up to be leaders on many of these issues. You've heard about chickens probably more than you would like, but same thing's happening on that. So that's a long-winded comment with a question at the end. What's to guarantee that we're not going to see cars here with copper in their brake pads if we don't pass this law, because it won't be, you know, illegal to sell them here.
Sure.
And as you've seen, we have, I mean, this salmon is an icon to the Northwest. I mean, I don't know how much time you spent in the Northwest, but it is a very, very important part of our culture and our heritage. And we are spending millions and millions and millions of dollars as a state on a voluntary level, and we're also spending millions of dollars responding to recovery plans and requirements and regulations by the federal and state agencies. So this is one small thing we can do to try to prevent the copper that you know is a problem and you're addressing. So if you could comment on that, I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. The reason why we cannot support this particular piece of legislation is not the contents of this legislation. We supported, at the end of the day, both the California and Washington laws. If this bill had come up first, we would have gone on record in support of this bill. Not only that, we probably would have used this as a model legislation for other states had they decided to pursue this issue. So the content of the bill is not the problem for us. The problem for us is after Washington and California, we get to the point now where we have to provide administrative follow-ups to all of these various departments on states that decided to pass this law. Right now, California and Washington are trying to implement their particular pieces of their laws, and have been working with our industry, and they have run into some problems that are unique to their particular states, and these are minor issues that I believe could be solved down the road. But having said that, when we start having other states involved, it forces the industry, which is still trying to get away from its economic straits over the past 2 or 3 years, to spend resources, limited resources, valuable resources, both in money and manpower, to hire individuals, be it lawyers, lobbyists, consultants, to continue to monitor the activities of various departments throughout the country. And at a time when we don't feel that it's necessary, because we have been given a hard deadline in the state of California in particular, that by 2025 we must get rid of copper and brake pad materials, friction materials. And as we stated earlier, our industry sells on a national market. So once California has established their deadline, our brake friction material will not only be sold in California with 0% copper, but in Oregon, in Washington, and in all 47 other states, plus the District of Columbia. If this bill wasn't introduced in any way, you'd still receive the benefits of having 0% copper by 2025 for the vast majority of the formulated brakes out there. So it's not a question of we're not trying to meet we don't understand the effects of copper in salmon. The other thing about being Oregon being the so-called potential dumping ground for California and Washington, you have to assume that California and Washington would convert the entire vehicle fleet for that state to vehicles that no longer use copper in brake friction materials. That's not going to happen. It takes decades to phase out the current vehicle fleet for both of those states. That's one thing. Secondly, you're going to assume then that Oregon's vehicle fleet population would increase dramatically to equal Washington and California's population. The only way we would sell non-compliant brake friction material is if the vehicle population in the state increases dramatically. And other than that, there is no rational reason for a wholesaler or a distributor to purchase non-compliant brake friction material only to stay in their inventory, only to stay in their shelves, when the vehicle population of the state of Oregon is probably not going to change over time. So there's no market for these excess brake friction material from California or Oregon. And lastly, I would say if we had a choice of states, it probably wouldn't be Oregon. It would be the other states that are more populous than Oregon, Pennsylvania, Florida, Texas, where the excess capacity would probably be taken up a lot sooner.
Senator Persansky, I think you had a question.
I do. Thank you. Nelson, if I can just follow up. In hearing the discussion and stuff, I'm wondering by if we move forward with the bill, because it has similarities or very similar to Washington State, does that somehow help, let's say, push the federal government to the point of where they may, say, step in and say, this is going to be the standard. We will introduce this, or we'll do this state nationwide, and bottom line, preempt out other states from maybe doing something that would be different from that standard.
Yes, Senator. Senator Dingfelder, Senator Persansky. We don't have any evidence right now that the federal government has identified this as an issue for them. And therefore, it would take, obviously, as Chair Dingfelder has stated earlier, that there would have to be a dramatic movement by other states to get their attention. Right now, the only other states that are considering legislation of similar nature is New York State. Rhode Island did introduce legislation last term, but the person who sponsored that legislation was defeated in the last election, so we don't know who's going to be introducing that bill in Rhode Island. There was some discussion that Alaska may try to do it.
Brakes are put on it.
But the problem is that we are not guaranteed a deadline of when all these states are going to introduce legislation. So in the meantime, we're being forced to provide administrative requirements, to do administrative requirements for both California and Washington, possibly Oregon, possibly other states. But there's no guarantee, and nobody can give us a specific deadline that the federal government will say, at this point in time, after 20 states have agreed to sign on, that we will therefore enact national legislation for this. So in the meantime, we're spending a lot of money on providing administrative work when it's not really necessary.
One follow-up, please. Based on the two states that you are complying with administrative, can you give us a ballpark of what you believe the cost is to the industry or your members for complying with that those standards?
If I may just go ahead and add that to you, Madam Chair and Senator Prezinski.
Madam Chair and Senator Prezinski. the cost we're investing in our industry to remove copper?
To comply with whatever forms you are filling out and giving them their updates.
Can you state your name again for people listening?
Frank Elovetto with Advix North America. Yeah, it's pretty complicated in our reporting, because not only do we do business with the automakers, there's reporting there, and then we're going to reporting for each of these states. But for a company like ours, it's not a big hit, because I'm part of that 8 large OE manufacturers, but there's 70 other manufacturers that supply brake pads in this industry, and some of them have very small staffs. And some of them have maybe one technical person on their staff. So for them, you know, this type of reporting could add 1 to 2 people to their administrative staffs.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify, there is no reporting requirement in this bill. I don't know if you saw the dash threes. So you may be basing that on what you're assuming you'll have to report in California and Washington. I could have DEQ come back up to clarify that if you want, but that is one thing that we did. I don't know if you saw this last version.
I think that's a question. I mean, if the reporting requirements, it seems to be what I'm hearing the concern at this point, if those are actually removed, would that change your position if you had a chance?
Madam Chair, Senator Prezinski, we are assuming then that the Department of Environmental Quality would agree point by point with the requirements of California's and Washington's own departments on the reporting requirements. Who's to say that in the state of Oregon you have other priorities or other concerns or other data that you would like to see that is specific to the state of Oregon, which would require us to provide some additional data for your state?
Nelson, I appreciate that. I think for the chair, would I like it, not now, but I think at some point before we take this up for work session, I'd like more information as to what DEQ would expect, because that would make a difference.
And we did discuss this in the work group. So, I don't know if your work group representative shared that with you, but we had quite a bit of discussion about what the reporting requirements would be, because we were very sensitive to that. Mm. And we'd heard concerns about the amount of reporting requirements in California and Washington. So, any other questions? I know we're running out of time, and we still have 3 more people that would like to testify. Senator Hess?
Thanks. I'm following the thought process of Senator Prezinski, too, and I know it's apples and oranges, but we were the third state to ban DECA PBDE, and after that domino fell, the federal government did adopt national standards on that environmental issue. And I just can't imagine the members of Congress not wanting to do this on a smaller scale. Sounds like what we would do when cities pass ordinances to get everybody in the same playing field. It just makes a lot of sense.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, my response to that is that there hasn't been, at least my experience and I monitor the federal, both House of Representatives and the Senate environmental committees, because they have jurisdiction over issues that I'm concerned about. The thing is, though, I don't know how many other states out there have salmon as one of their priorities on the environmental level. As Vice Chair Olson stated earlier, the state of Wyoming does not have salmon, and I dare say the vast majority of the states in this country probably don't have the same problems that you're facing as it relates to fisheries in general. So we're not guaranteed that there's going to be a tremendous movement after the state of Oregon, that there's going to be a movement to make this a national priority. And we're not hearing anything right now from both government, from both House and Senate in Washington.
We have 3 more people that would like to testify, so I'm going to wrap this up. But I just want to add, I think we're going to hear from the League of Oregon Cities, because even though salmon is a big factor here, it also has to do with water quality standards as well, as I'm sure you know, and meeting TMDLs and all the other fun acronyms that we could throw out at you.
Yes, absolutely. But we're familiar with those acronyms,
yeah.
Madam Chair.
Well, I just want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Both of you gentlemen for coming out and boosting our economy, as I always like to tell people from Washington, D.C.
We do everything we can.
Enjoying our liquid sunshine.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we'll look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we have just a few more folks that signed up that would like to testify: Teresa Huntsinger, Chris Fick, and Peggy Lynch. And I am going to mention, Peggy, you can come up.
I'm sure my testimony.
All right, but you're welcome to come up if you'd like. We only had a couple people that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 600. We've decided to carry that over since Senator Johnson, who is the chief sponsor, couldn't be here in person. So if anybody is here for Senate Bill 600, we're carrying that over until next Tuesday. Is that right? Today's Thursday, correct?
That is.
Okay. Okay. Who would like to go first?
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Teresa Huntsinger, and I'm the Program Director for Clean and Healthy Rivers at the Oregon Environmental Council. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 945, phasing out copper brake pads in Oregon. You've already heard that how copper is toxic to salmon. Copper is found in brake pads as a major source of copper, and it's found in our stormwater runoff and in our rivers. California and Washington have both passed legislation phasing out copper in brake pads. So we think that it is important for Oregon to join our neighbors to the north and south and make this consistent legislation across the West Coast. We do know, as you heard from the folks who testified earlier, that copper brake pads are a source of pollution that can be replaced with a safer alternative. So we believe that it is time to go ahead and take action and make that change. And I also remind you to consider the millions of dollars that are spent on restoring habitat for salmon. If we restore that habitat but we still have problems with water quality, such as copper, we're not going to be successful and those millions of dollars will be wasted. So as I was looking into this bill and trying to understand more about whether there are copper-free brake pads out there, I spoke with a friend of mine who is a watershed extension agent. He's an education expert. And he had I had heard that he had bought copper-free brake pads, and I wanted to find out, well, where did he get those? There are copper-free brake pads available now. So it turns out that he had actually purchased ceramic brake pads. And ceramic brake pads are often recommended by mechanics because they last longer, they don't wear out as quickly, they're not as noisy. So as I was doing this research, I came to understand, and I thought it might help you to sort of understand the different types of brake pads that are out there, that the brake pads that are often called metallic or semi-metallic brake pads are made primarily of steel. And in fact, it's actually the ceramic brake pads where instead of using steel, they use ceramic that has copper fibers in it. So this friend of mine who thought that he was doing the right thing by, instead of buying metallic brake pads, choosing ceramic brake pads and paying much more for those, he might have actually been getting brake pads that were higher in copper content than the metallic brake pads that he could have chosen. So it just helps you, it's just a point that it's not clear when you're replacing your brake pads what kind of copper content they have in them today. And it can be difficult for consumers, as there is going to be more growing demand as people become aware of this issue, to make that choice on their own without any kind of legislation. So I did also do a little bit of research trying to understand if copper-free brake pads are in fact available. And I found that there are actually some companies that are developing copper-free brake pads, and they're using this as a growth opportunity for their businesses as they're trying to come into and develop brake pads that come into compliance with the Washington and the California requirements. So you can see in my written testimony there's a company that's manufacturing EcoStop pads, which they claim are the world's first full line of copper-free brake pads. There are also companies that have some that are meeting the 5% copper requirement available now, and that also are working on some that should be available in 2012 that meet the 0.5% copper requirement. So that's 13 years in advance of when that 2025 study on the 0.5% level would be required. So let's see. So this shows you that some of these copper-free brake pads are available now and others are currently in development. I did want to note that this bill applies only to new cars, which is, and while it is similar in many ways to the Washington bill does actually include aftermarket brakes. And while we would like to see aftermarket brakes included as well, we do think that this bill is an important step. And that's why we are supporting Senate Bill 945. I do want to note, though, that as DEQ is developing the rules for implementing this bill, So it does require that, that brake friction material would be marked with proof of certification in a manner that's prescribed by the department, that it wouldn't be very difficult for DEQ to do that in a way that enables the aftermarket brake pad manufacturers who are not actually required to meet these low copper levels. If they are in fact meeting those copper levels, you could make that certification in a way that they could voluntarily use that certification so that it could help consumers make those choices if they're looking for low copper brake pads. Thank you for bringing forward this bill and the opportunity to testify.
And I take all the testimony and then we still have one more person who was absent at the beginning because I did call your name, Daryl, who also wants to testify. But we'll go ahead and get this and take the question. Senator Thompson. Yep.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, other members of the committee. Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. From our perspective, it sounds trite, but an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure in this case. It's our understanding that a good percentage of copper that enters Oregon's waterways comes from brake pad material. It's a particular problem in our cities because, as has been mentioned before, brake pad material settles on our roadways, becomes dissolved in our stormwater, and then runs into our rivers via stormwater. A lot of the technology that cities are using to try and catch some of the stuff that we want to keep out of our stormwater, such as retrofitting our storm drain systems with inserts, are ineffective at treating copper. Infiltration ponds and rain gardens are more effective, but the size needed to have these facilities in places that are already well populated and crowded is cost prohibitive. So in terms of a cost-effective standpoint, in terms of an efficiency standpoint, we think reducing the amount of copper in these brake pads to begin with will be infinitely more effective at reducing the amount of copper that our systems have to treat. There's also, and Dr. McIntyre would undoubtedly be better suited to address this issue, but the water in the Willamette Valley, where a majority of our residents, Oregonians, reside, is soft water, and the copper interaction with soft water, which is low in magnesium and magnesium and calcium carbonate, actually has a bad effect and makes copper more toxic than in other areas of the country where we have hard water. So not only do we have a fish species that's, you know, extremely well regarded in the state and iconic, that's susceptible to copper, but we also have water that doesn't do them any favors when dealing with the toxicity of copper. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you guys have.
Thank you. Peggy?
So Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon, you have my testimony. I simply wanted to say that I was really excited to be able to come here today to support the industry because I thought that was what was going to happen. Having heard the interim testimony and knowing the work that you all had done to try to accommodate the industry and to make sure that you're working with the Washington standards. So I'm disappointed, but I do want you to know that the League certainly supports this bill and supports the efforts to deal with both the issue of the cost of the salmon recovery that we have today and the fact that we need clean, drinkable water in Oregon.
Thank you. Senator Thompson, a question?
Chair Dingfelder, thank you. I guess my question might end up being for the brake guys.
Okay. Well, why don't we do this? I'm going to have Daryl Fuller come up and give his testimony.
Okay.
Any questions for this panel
here? Yeah, I just didn't want them to
have one. Okay. And then we're going to bring Daryl up, and then I can bring him, but we are running out of time.
Okay. Just one quick question. I was just going to ask it so they'd be ready, maybe?
Okay.
Senator Olson didn't ask this question, so I have to, I guess. He must have missed one. What will be the added cost for changing the brake pads to getting the copper out? Will it cost the consumers more? Will they be $5 more, $10 more, $50 more brake pad? I hadn't asked that question.
Kate, you had a question for this panel?
Yes, from Ms. Hunsinger. You mentioned ceramic brake pads, and I was looking on Wikipedia. Ceramic brake pads also contain copper.
Right, that's what I said, is that ceramic brake pads have copper fibers in them. So choosing ceramic is not choosing copper-free. But there are those specific companies that I mentioned are actually developing ceramic brake pads that are copper-free.
And I have one question or one statement for Chris. Thank you, Chris. You say in your testimony that, to make sure I get the right one, an analysis of stormwater data collected around the state has found copper in stormwater at concentrations that may cause harmful effects. That's not scientific data if you say it may cause harmful effects. That's speculation.
Chairwoman Dingfelder, Senator Olson, the analysis that we did was conducted with the engineering firm Kennedy Jenks and Aqua, and rather it was comprehensive in the sense that we had samples from throughout the state, and those samples proved to have high levels of copper concentration according to DEQ standards, but we weren't prepared to use those and say that all entities, put a percentage on it, but it was in concentrations that the existing scientific evidence has shown may have harmful effects.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for sticking around. And Daryl?
Is this you were, or my other brother Daryl?
Is your other brother Daryl? Daryl, we did call you up. You were off calling another hearing.
We had folks come up so they're here.
Sure. But why don't you go ahead, because we're just about out of time.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller, thank you very much for giving me a rain check. I was next door with Senator Beyer and Senate Transportation, making sure dismantlers remove all the fluids and the mercury switches and get rid of the airbags before we crush motor vehicles. So I'm protecting the environment everywhere
good.
I go today.
That was a good bill.
We have, Madam Chair, I'm here today on behalf of two different clients, the Automotive Aftermarket Industry Association and Northwest Auto Trades Association. Both associations participated in the work group over the interim and have participated in the meetings we've had during the session. We appreciate the extreme efforts that you've gone to and that the staff have gone to make sure that industry folks are included in this process. And my comments are in reference to the Dash 3 amendments, not to the original bill. And We appreciate the changes that were made. We especially appreciate the change that was made in the standard for retailers, installers, and distributors, that it's a knowing standard in terms of installing brake pads that don't meet the standard. The original bill and the California and Washington legislation would penalize a retailer or an installer if they installed a brake that didn't meet the standard. And our concern was, as a small mechanic shop, we don't know if a brake is going to meet the standard or not. We're going to buy one that says that it's certified, but we have no way of independently testing it. So we requested in the amendments that for distributors and for installers and retailers, that they would only be penalized if they knowingly installed one, which protects small businesses in Oregon. And so while Washington and California don't include that provision, we certainly appreciate that you included that provision for us in the legislation. We have some concerns, ongoing concerns, about the bill as it moves forward. I wasn't here, so I don't know, but I suspect that my comments aren't going to be new, and that is, as Washington and California implement their legislation, we wonder aloud whether or not it would make more sense for us to sit back and watch that process a little bit more before we act, to find out what sort of problems they may have, and believe that there is probably time to look at this further as they implement, as opposed to going in and passing legislation immediately. We understand the value and the reasons why you want to have a solid block of states, if you will, in terms of trying to push manufacturers and the federal government going forward. But we're just not convinced that speed is necessarily the way to go at this particular time. And then our other concern is the cost to DEQ, and where that money is going to come from. And I stated in my testimony that we would object to any sort of mechanism that would require retailers or installers to pay a fee in order to cover the cost of the DEQ program that would eventually be involved in testing and doing the things that are needed to implement that. Save those concerns. I said we're very, very pleased at the responsiveness of the chair and staff and hearing out our concerns. concerns in making substantial changes, and the product in the Dash 3 amendment is substantially more user-friendly and more consumer-friendly and more business-friendly than where we started from, and we appreciate that.
Thank you, Daryl. And while you're out of the room, we did talk about both those issues. And as you know, there is no fee to the manufacturer or retailers in this bill, even though that was discussed in the work group. And we did have a discussion about helping push the federal level, because these gentlemen had similar concerns about whether this is needed. And we made the analogy to what happened in DECA, and the federal government did act when they saw that states were moving that way, partially because the industry went to the federal government and said, we need to act on a federal standard. So appreciate that, and we did talk about both those things when we were out of the room.
I suspected you had, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to address the question about costs, and then we can wrap up?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Thompson.
Okay.
This one?
No.
Daryl, I guess stay. There's one other question.
Right. My apologies.
At this time, with the reformulation, we don't
Could you state your name again? I'm sorry.
Frank Oliveto.
Thank you.
Excuse me. At this time, we don't have an exact number of what it's going to cost to the consumer, but as a manufacturing company, we know the consumer is not willing to pay more money for the product. And as an OE supplier, I know the OE manufacturers are not willing to pay more for the product from us either as a brake pad. So as a manufacturer, our target is not to increase the price. So this is the slippery slope we're on the development. How can we remove copper and keep the cost down? And that's one of the obstacles we have right now that we're working on.
And I'll do a follow-up to that, because we discussed this in my office. With the price of copper right now, you actually might end up saving money. In the long run.
In the long run, yes. That's one of our targets, because of the extreme cost that we're going to have to develop the product, testing and that thing. We hope to recover it that way. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I do have
question.
One question for Mr. Fuller. Mm-hmm. Since this is going to be phased in over a long period of time, I'm just curious, how many cars are we going to have on the road in 2021 that still have the old copper metallic brakes?
Do you want to do the math off the top of your head?
Yeah, Darryl? Madam Chair, Senator Olson, thank you so much for asking me that question.
Is math not your favorite subject?
Idea. Yeah. There's a reason why I studied political science and not math in college. I will tell you, based on research that I'm doing for other legislation in the building, that right now the current fleet of vehicles in the state of Oregon, about 35% of them are 10 years old or older. So about two-thirds of the fleet tend to be newer cars, 10 years old or newer. So assuming that trend stays about the same, I mean, that can give you some sense of what the turnover of vehicles is in new versus an older model vehicle, if that helps. And I'd be happy to get those numbers for you if I can find them someplace.
All right. Any other questions? All righty. So thank you very much, gentlemen. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 945. Oh, yes. And just another announcement that we're going to carry over Senate Bill 600, which we ran out of time for. We will have that on our agenda for Tuesday. With that, we are adjourned.